All right, so welcome back to Nuggets on the Go banter series. And today we're going to talk about a very interesting topic. And in particularly, we're going to talk about on-block sales in Singapore.
Because you could take a potential view of where the market trend is likely to take place. And why is that important? Is because when you start an on-block, and by the time that you actually get your 80% put it up in market, it might well be a year after you initiate it, could be year plus. And you know how it is, Singapore's market tends to be dynamic.
Right, with us today, we have Mr. Kramjit Singh, renowned expert. Can I call you an expert, Mr. Kramjit?
Hopefully not. It adds more pressure on us.
All right. On-block sales has been, of course, highly sought after topic, especially starting from 2021, all the way, surprisingly, until the Q1 portion of 2023, because later as we deep dive, there are quite a lot of news actually on a couple of on-block sales that's happening. Of course, a lot of projects has also been put up for on-block tender as well. And later, we're going to deep dive with quite a fair bit of questions for Mr. Kramjit. So just a quick introduction on Mr. Kramjit. He is currently the CEO of Show Suite, as well as the Lhasa. And he has more than 30 years of experience in the real estate industry. So just a quick glimpse on his experience previously with Colliers as a kickstart of his real estate journey. And then he set up Credo Real Estate. And after that, in Jones Lang, LaSalle, on which he then set up his current two companies, which De La Salle deals with consultancy on block sales, as well as high-end investment sales as well for property owners. And of course, Show Suite is a technology company that collaborates and assists developers on their new launch projects. And we'll deep dive later on some of the things that he's working on. So welcome, Kramjit.
Well, thank you for having me.
Right. Great to have you here, because it's not easy to find an on-block expert in the market. And maybe a quick introduction to our audience. Share with us a little bit about your experience in the on-block scene. And of course, I think our audience is very keen to know some of the projects that you have worked on in the past that has been successful as well.
Yeah, so on-block is clearly a very hot and at the same time sensitive topic amongst private property owners. It involves money, it involves potentially being forced out of your homes. Sometimes it does get dramatic, but most of the times not. It usually leads to very happy outcomes. But because it could potentially be disruptive on one hand, it could potentially be profit-making on the other hand, especially if the owners are looking at it from an investor's lens, it naturally becomes a very lucrative and important topic for people to want to track. On-block typically happens when the value of the land far exceeds the sum total value of the parts. So it gives rise to an arbitrage. And why do we face that in Singapore? And why is this a fairly uniquely Singapore phenomena? Is number one, we've got a very small island market, and wealth has been on the rise. We are accommodating more and more population. So that gives rise to the need to intensify existing use of property. While the government is the major supplier of land that gives rise to condominiums, which is the predominant form of housing in the private space. But many a times it does make sense for us to see our old properties be recycled for new properties and put to better, more productive use. So on that, from that perspective, the government felt that it is a phenomenon to be supported, and which is why they took a view that they should actually make it easier to actually facilitate on blocks without requiring all the owners to agree to a proposition, but at the same time, the necessary safeguards to ensure that the interests of the minorities who have not agreed to it, their interests are duly protected. So that legislation got kicked in 1999 that paved the way for 80%, generally 80% of the owners to consent to an on-block proposition, prior to that, when it all got started in 93, 94, which is basically 30 years ago, it did require everybody to agree. And that gave rise to quite a number of wrong practices, undesirable behavior, profit-taking, and very distasteful conclusions to some of the deals.
Mm, right. So would you be able to share with us, like, through a journey in real estate, what has been some of the projects that you have been involved in the past?
Okay, so we've been involved with, in different capacities. I mean, I've kind of worked under in Colliers, then GLL, then I set up Credo and ran that for 10 years. And then after that, we merged with GLL. So I had two stints with GLL. And throughout that 30-year process, I think it's been close to 100 on blocks that I'd been involved with in one form or the other. The biggest in the market in our history, in Singapore's history, is Farrer Court. And that still stands to be the largest ever successfully organized on block, involving 600 over apartment owners, amounting to $1.3 billion. So in quantum, in land mass, land size, it still stands to be the largest. And so, and this obviously was a very team effort, and we were very proud and very well privileged to be involved with that success.
Right. So that, of course, in today's term will be de-leading.
That's correct.
And in your perspective, will such a huge en bloc ever happen again? Based on today's cooling measures, the new restrictions and things like that?
Yep. So you've hit it right on the nail. So large scale is no longer a positive attribute. It unfortunately has become a handicap. And that's arising from measures that forces developers to buy, build and sell any project, almost irrespective of the scale and the size or the number of units, within 5 years. So whether it is five apartments that they're building, five homes they're building, or 500 units or 5,000 units, they still got 5 years to buy, build and sell. And bear in mind, within the 5 years, 1 year is typically taken with the planning, designing, preparation for launch. So in all sense, it's about 4 years. So when you've got a mega scale project involving, say, more than 1,000 or 1,005 or 2,000, then that's where the risk escalates quite extraordinarily. And that's where developers will say, well, I'll rather spread my capital across multiple and smaller projects than lumping all into one large ones.
Right. Maybe talk a little bit about this, of course, very famous project, Mandarin Gardens, right? I think the most recent attempt was like maximum at about 68%. And of course, this project has been one of the key favorites that a lot of people are looking at. Plus, there was another mega one, which is at Bradel. Yeah. So do you think these two developments, in the event, if let's say one day they could achieve 80%, what kind of configuration will developers do it in terms of having a successful tender bid? Would they like combine forces, or like usually what do you think will be the calibration for this kind of mega projects if it were to happen?
Well, I think, you know, that before that actually can materialize, right. I think it's about assessing and mitigating the risk on the part of the developer in undertaking any large and super large, and whether it's Mandarin Gardens, whether it's Bradel View, whether it's many out there that they do want to attempt. The key challenge is the commercial risk around needing to pay the penalty for failing to sell out all the units, which is a real issue. So if most developers can't wrap their heads around that risk and the costs associated with the failure to meet the requirements, then very likely developers will just say, well, we'll just shy away from it. It's not a matter of pricing. It's just how do we price in the commercial risk? So that would generally be our advice to the mega scale on blocks. Right. And that's nothing taking away from the attractiveness of these projects. And these are all, they enjoy very attractive attributes from a marketing perspective, but it's just the scale has now become a handicap.
Right, right. I think for today's podcast, what we want to achieve is also to come from three different perspectives. One is through the lenses of existing owners in such projects that has on-block potential. The second one will be from the developer's point of view on what are the factors that attracts them to actually bid for a development. Third one will be from the lens of individual retail home purchasers that, you know, maybe some purchasers, they love older developments because of the vast landscape, open parking and stuff like that. But should they actually take the risk to buy developments because maybe after owning it for 1 year, they renovated it and then they call for on block and stuff like that. So maybe we can start from the first perspective. Want to put your thought process a little bit just to give an introduction of the generic sales process of starting from the process of forming a committee, usually on a sequential approach. How does this work if we're coming from an existing condo owner point of view?
Right. So I think the first thing they need to do is to get some advice as whether fundamentally is that project ready for an en bloc in that given market. Of course, you could take a potential view of where the market trend is likely to take place. And why is that important? Is because when you start an en bloc and by the time that you actually get your 80% put it up in the market, it might well be a year after you initiate it, could be year plus. So, and you know how it is, Singapore's market tends to be dynamic. So a general sense of market movements is important, getting an honest assessment of the premium an on block can deliver to the owners. And again, whether the owners would be better off having unblocked it, receive that premium, and bearing in mind that if that's a home, they would need to replace the home. And if they've got configuration, size, preferences that can be easily met by buying resale homes, whether it's, you know, they're looking at, you know, a lateral move, an upgrade or a downgrade, then they will have to assess, you know, whether that can truly deliver a happy premium, a happy outcome, so to speak. What we've seen of late is many on-blockers don't mind enjoying a lesser premium because it is an opportunity to realize a dream to downgrade. So when you're downgrading, then you tend to be more forgiving with your options available when buying a replacement home, because it's all about maybe downsizing or potentially buying a HDB flat and enjoying the savings, which will help their later years in life. So that's one profile. Then there's obviously another profile that's looking at a upgrade to their housing form arising from that premium or the profits or so, and can that deliver? We've also seen a situation, and it's probably a new manifestation of a new problem, is most of the on-block projects and those, the wannabes, tend to have apartments where the sizes are large, because compared to the new age apartments where developers are beginning to build smaller and smaller, and they are beginning to struggle with replacement of as large a size as they enjoy currently for the sums of money that they'll be receiving. And that's a genuine issue and challenge most large apartment owners are facing. So because of the variety of unique challenges, we have seen lots of on-blocks that have come onto the market with 80% mandate, but they have failed to find a buyer. And that success rate is dropping. And what I mean by that is that there have been multiple on-block cycles. It comes, goes, comes and goes. But this current on-block cycle is probably one of those cycles with the lowest success rate or probability of success. And that's because of this new found challenge, unique challenge, where the current profile of on-blocks are struggling to find suitably large apartments as replacement, because most of the new age apartments are very small and they're not accustomed to it.
Right. Usually, how many years is a cycle?
Good question. Look back in history, we've had mega cycles, we have mini cycles, and usually it's about 5-year gap between a mega and a mini, and then another 5 years later for another mega, and then it tends to be a mini or so. So it's up and down, but within the ups and down, you've got the large ones and the not so large ones.
So 2023, are we in a mega or mini cycle?
We're in a mini, cycle. We're in a mini cycle, and even within the mini cycle, it's a mini cycle with a low probability of success.
Right.
So which is unique.
You forecast that the next mega cycle will be 2028?
Well, if you go back in history and you look at what constitutes, what drives cycles, ups and downs, and what gives rise to on blocks, then yeah, that we could be looking at another mega one,
right?
Maybe 4 or 5 years from now.
Right. You only seem like you have a question for Kranjit.
Oh no, as in because 2007-2008 was one of the mega cycles. That's where Ferrocorp was on block.
That's right.
And then 2017-2018 we have another high cycle. Mega, like 2018 yeah. We have like 10.8 billion in terms of the value of on block. And then last year was about 3.6 billion, right? So like we are currently at like the mini cycle version of it. But of course, Ferrocorp still stands at the only property that has an unblocked value above 1 billion. Of course, there are some projects that are trying to challenge that, but we have failed. I'm just very curious because you mentioned that the risk factors of developers going for this mega sites due to the 5-year additional buyer stamp duty gap if they fail to finish the sales of all the properties. But actually over the last, let's say in the 2017-2018 on block cycle, actually all those big sites, the developer actually performed very well. Like for example, Park Astar, Jadescape, Florence Residences, yeah. Treasure at Tampines, but they're all from HUDC, of course.
That's correct.
Yeah. So what are your thoughts on like the some of the remaining HUDCs like Laguna Park, Ivory Heights and a Bradley View, etc.?
Yeah, so you're right. Parkester is about, I think, about 1,400 units. Then you've got other projects that were successful, delivering also about 1,400, 1,600. And I think the largest that stands right now is
Treasury Tampines,
which is 2,200. They turn out okay because the market was on their side. And you know how it is, the market could well not be on your side when you're holding the inventory and you've got only 4 years of play there. Bearing in mind the first year and maybe potentially slightly more than a year goes down to planning, preparation for launch. So again, when you look back in time, the market saved many of these developers. And if the market was not as buoyant, not as strong as they were and they have been, then it could have led to detrimental situations, which many prudent and large developers will have to price in the risk. Mm. So if it doesn't come to that situation where they need to pay, then that's fine. But you will have to price that in just out of prudence.
Because I was just thinking that actually for developers, it is always easier to just go for government land sales. They don't need to play. They don't need to top up the premium. They don't need to pay the development charge, etc. And then they also all these risks that you mentioned.
True. So GLS represents the most plain vanilla form, usually with lesser hidden issues that might lead to a delay in getting the new project approved design or so. So the turnaround period tends to be much quicker. Not much quicker, but I should not say that, but quicker. Quicker and more straightforward. And bearing in mind this 5-year rule, the design of the GLS land parcels typically give rise to about 500 to 600 units. And I think that's the sweet spot. That's what developers love. That's the optimal size because they also need some degree of scale to make it cost efficient, some economies of scale there, but not too large that it becomes a handicap.
Right. And by default, would you think that a developer will always prefer a GLS compared to en bloc? Because sometimes en bloc can be complicated in the sense and they still have to spend additional time to tear down and things like that.
So the demolition is not a problem. Usually processes ask fairly standard. So I think en blocs in itself is not a problem from a developer's perspective. I think the answer to that is the value proposition, the price at which it comes to the market,
right.
And the location. I'll give you an example. If it's mass market, most of the end buyers of the homes are used to 99-year leasehold condominiums. So whether it's a GLS product or whether it is a Treasure and Tampines type of product, it caters to the same end audience. But when you're dealing with high-end luxury homes, like say those close to Orchard Road, many a times the home buyers would insist on freehold or nothing.
Mm.
So, and that can't be sourced from the government land sales program because the GLS program by default sells leasehold properties. And the only source or credible source for land for such luxury homes with freehold title comes from en bloc sales. Mm. So the answer to that, it depends.
Right. And just to deviate a little bit, I mean, now in the year 2023, our GLS in terms of launch pricing for OCR is already $2,000 upwards, yeah. All the way to 2004. And then RCR is at $2,400 upwards as well. And then of course, CCR will be $3,000 onwards. So where do you think this will lead us to in the next 5 years? Like how are pricing going to look like? Maybe by 2028, what is your own opinion on the GLS pricing?
Okay, so that's an entirely different subject yeah. altogether. So if the question is more around general movement of our homes here in Singapore, then I think you need to take a step back as to why are they still so resilient, so buoyant, despite the fact that we went through a major economic crisis driven by COVID that brought many economies, markets down, and also the new headwinds, which is high interest rates. Despite these two factors, our home prices have remained resilient, buoyant. Not only that, rentals also have gone up. The reasons for that, multiple. Singapore's real estate size is limited, and that's very profound, that's fundamental. Many cities can grow and grow and grow sideways. We can't. We can only grow upwards. And we do need to grow because we are supporting a larger and larger population base, naturalized Singaporeans, as well as through immigration. So that's the direction that we are heading towards too. GLS does form the bulk of the supply, but en blocs also help fill in the gaps where needed. So on one hand, we've got these factors. On the other hand, you've got unique factors such as high savings amongst our households here. And it's a huge phenomena. The household net worth, which comprises value of assets, savings, CPF, has been on the rise consistently for years now. And that in itself has doubled in the last 10, 11 years. So if you were to chart it, it would just be a consistent rise and rise. And it's just a reflection of how much accumulated wealth there is in Singapore. So that's another unique phenomenon. Then you've got the CPF design. It's for savings. And when you have four savings that can only be predominantly used for housing, then you can imagine how much of that funds actually goes towards financing homes that brings down the, makes properties a bit more affordable once you have a loan. And that also supports and underpins high real estate values here. The next unique phenomena is we've got very high home ownership rates, which is 90%+. Many, many markets, many societies, many countries, they're far less, about 50-60%, at most 70%. So we've got something that's unique here because of that. And that's also because of our HDB policies. When you add all of these up, they do point to fundamental factors that supports high real estate prices, because everyone's a asset owner. So when prices move up, generally everybody benefits from it. So there's unlocking of capital and profit that allows, you know, the upgrading effect to take place and so on and so forth.
Right.
And on that note, HDB has done a marvelous, marvelous job in supplying affordable homes, good quality, supported by infrastructure, and so it becomes a privilege to be a Singaporean because you're given grants, and you're buying HDB at now in relative terms to private homes, maybe one third or one quarter of a condo that might be just next to the HDB flat, BTO flat also. Right. So when you consider the uplift that happens after MOP and all these factors put together, it basically points to elevated home prices. Now, back to your question, why, you know, prices have been rising and where do we see things? There's always going to be some headwinds around, but barring major headwinds, and we've gone through major ones at the global level, and because of new costs that developers will have to absorb that has been thrown at them. When you add it all up, a project that would have maybe they needed to sell at, say, $2,000 per square foot, now all of a sudden their costs have gone up to a point where they would have to price it at least 20% higher than, let's say, 5 years ago. So, and what has given rise, what has happened over there? You've got stamp duties have gone up for property developers.
Mm.
They will have to pass it down, and because that adds to their production costs.
Right.
Interest rates have gone up, and most developers, in fact, practically 90%+ of developers do borrow money in order to increase their returns on capital.
Right.
So interest rates have gone up. Now, the new phenomena is the definition of GFA and what is saleable has now changed, and that's going to change in May, June this year, which would mean that the saleable strata area calculation is going to drop for the same cost. So that's going to affect how they are going to price their new properties going forward. DC rates are constantly being reviewed. And the next big one is construction costs. Construction costs has gone up because of COVID-led challenges. There's disruption of supply chain, material costs have gone up. And the big one is manpower costs. When you add all of this up, prices have just gone up and up. And you're right, mass market is in the $2,000 plus territory, and which was maybe not long ago quite unthinkable.
Right, right. So in 5 years' time, what's your rough crystal ball? I mean, we'll put in a disclaimer here for you first. Your own prediction, like where will prices be in, let's say, OCRA?
There are reasons why eventually prices can come down and why Singapore's real estate market can also be tamed. So there are unique, there's no such thing as prices will continue to rise and not come down.
Right.
So there are those. But barring that scenario, I think our home prices can continue to rise easily 5-6% year on year. So if you were to accumulate that 5 years from now, that could well be about 20-30% from where we are right now.
Right, which is like perhaps the OCR will be like 2005 PSF starting from. Right, we'll come back to that to end this episode. But George, you have a couple of questions. Let's go back to from an existing condo owner's point of view on the en-bloc process. Maybe I'll kickstart first, then I'll pass to George. Do you think it's actually a very tiring process for the existing owners to kickstart and initiate this whole thing in order to achieve 80%? And usually, how long does it take before they actually approach a consultancy to come in and then get their lawyers in and also the tender bid and all that kind of stuff?
Right. So I think it goes back to sequential process. So one is the informal assessment of whether it's viable and whether is it timely. If the honest assessment is, yes, it sounds like a good enough time and we're quite happy with the potential premium, and if on top of that there are push factors, maybe maintenance issues or so, then it should lead to the next step, which would require the owners to requisite for an EOGM. And the purpose of calling for that EOGM is to elect a sales committee. So when you eventually, when you eventually hold that EOGM, the owners need to come together and elect a committee by giving them express powers as to what they can, they can't do. But the most fundamental would be to engage the services of a property consultant and a lawyer who would need to advise them on the steps ahead, guide them through it in a setting of a sensible reserve price, what would be the best way of distributing the sale proceeds amongst the different unit types. And many, many times you could have a mixed-use development in the development. How do you deal with that? Bearing in mind that sometimes the distribution of share value messes things up. How do you find your balances so that it's fair and equitable to everybody, which is the paramount duty of a sales committee and to act as a trustee for all owners. Having done that, and you've engaged the services of a lawyer and a property consultant, that's where collectively they produce a proposal and thereby calling the second EOGM. Explain to all owners that this is the reserve price that we're proposing. And the reserve price by nature means that will be the minimum price that you would receive should the deal be successful. And with a view of going to the market and trying to achieve that or a higher price, depending on the outcome of the market of the marketing tender. And also go on to explain what it means for each and every of the unit, because while you need to know the global reserve price, but you also need to know how much it means to you specifically for your size or so. Timelines, the legal issues, all that would need to be explained. And at the close of that meeting, if an owner feels that they're very happy with the entire proposition, that's when they would need to endorse it by signing on an agreement. That agreement is called a collective sale agreement. A sales committee can have up to a year to solicit for at least 80% consent, written consent to the CSA. And if within that 1 year they fail to secure 80%, then obviously that puts an end to the process. Like that, there are several other timelines that they need to work within. So that's pretty much the most important timeline. And the moment 80% is obtained, that's when the consultants will put it up for sale by tender, market it, draw bids at the close of a tender. If the tender is unsuccessful, then the sales committee has up to 10 weeks to negotiate on a private treaty basis. If that also fails, then they probably have one more shot at another tender exercise before it also comes to a natural end. If the tender or the private treaty negotiation is successful, then it does mean that there would be a binding contract between the developer and majority of the owners, but that would be conditional upon several factors being met. One of the key factors that sets out as a condition precedent would be procuring the consent of the Strata Titles Board or High Court or Supreme Court, depending on the nature, that forces the rest of the owners to be a party of the agreement. And then only a developer can complete the purchase, collect, and they receive the titles, collapse titles, and then proceed towards redeveloping it also. So in a nutshell, that's kind of the sequence of events. Mm. And many a times you see each project taking a different route, depending on whether they're able to achieve 80% at a sensible enough price, whether they're able to achieve a buyer at that price or more, or whether it's, they need to go through a negotiation below the reserve price, which will require the committee going back to the owners for a fresh new updated mandate below the reserve price.
So Kram, just share with us, like, maybe this is like more on the ground question, in case some condo sellers are very interested in The sales committee, usually how many people does it include? Like, how many people does it comprise of? Do they have, are they remunerated for this effort? And usually, does it depend on like, is it like a 20-man team for a 1,000-unit project, or like how does it work?
So the law actually sets out the upper limit and the lower limit. Mm. So the upper limit is 14. So you can't possibly elect a committee that's more than 14 members. And that's irrespective of the size of the development. And a minimum would be 3. And there's a need to at least elect 3 members out of committee members to represent the owners when it, you know, you need to litigate over it, which is when you go through a strata titles board application, High Court or Supreme Court. So the right fit is, you know, anywhere between 3 to 14. I mean, there are some wisdom in setting out an odd number size of a committee, so 7, 9, whatever. But again, what is important is to ensure that all unit types are duly represented in the committee. And what I mean by that is that you could have mixed use, you could have a development with a wide array of sizes, big, large, medium, and So it's important that the voices of all these factions are duly represented in the committee, and so that it could lead to the best possible decision that's not driven by favoritism one way or the other. Are they remunerated? They're absolutely not. It's a thankless
volunteers.
Job. They are all volunteers, unpaid volunteers. Not only are they unpaid volunteers, they actually have the duty of care to act in the best interest of all owners. The court has likened their role to that of a trustee. And so you do need to be above board. You've got to declare any potential conflict of interest. So, for example, if a committee member is also happens to be a property developer or be working for a property developer, that would be the first thing that the committee member would need to declare before his or her name is put up for election into the sales committee. Whether he has he or she has an interest in a property consultancy firm, a lawyer that wished to bid for the project. These are all potential conflict of interest. Not to say that he or she can't sit in the committee, but you need to do the right and the timely declaration.
So I think just now earlier we mentioned that we are right now like kind of in the mini cycle. Does it mean that, there's a series of questions. So does it mean that number one, whoever is, you know, trying to go for the en bloc purchase, they are a lot more cautious? Or could it be because they are also weighing the fact that they want to go for what might be coming up in the government land sale? Unless, you know, the site plots possess very, very good attributes. And speaking of good attributes, maybe I just throw a project name. Just for us to really banter. Euro Asia Park, which is just right beside, wouldn't say exactly beside, about 600 odd meters away from Woodley MRT station, sits on a freehold plot. Within 1 km, they have schools, 2 km, they have schools, pretty good plots, and in the RCR area. Reserve price is at $500 million. I guess, in your opinion, it's not cheap. Why has there been no takers, number one? And then, in your opinion, I think sitting on the lens of the homeowners, there are also a lot of jittery because they will be thinking, do they sell? And then they also wouldn't want to sell cheap because they are also thinking of their replacement home that is, you know, on a higher price point. And then if they were to change from like a 4-bedder to another 4-bedder, the overall size would have reduced by 20-30% to a newer development, probably a 99 years. What should they do? And then should they wait or should they kind of bite the bullet, say, okay, there are no takers, I sell now and then I leverage on opportunity cost, I buy into something else, you know, instead of waiting, because there is always an unknown and the developers would then be thinking, should they go for this en bloc,
this one need to pay consultancy fee.
Go
really?
For, you know. So I believe this is definitely on a lot of.
I'm losing track with the number of questions.
So I'm sure there's
a lot of bias. In short, is what should you do if you're in Euro Asia Park?
One example, yes.
I think it will be more appropriate not to answer in specific terms to any particular project, because there's a lot of unique factors that go into every project's pricing.
Of course.
So I can't comment on, say, 500 million, whether it's a right price or not right price. Of course, yeah. But let's speak in general terms. Mm. So what's happening to the market and why developers are shying away from bidding for on blocks? The answer to that question is, in the past, if they were to buy a piece of land, an on block, at, say, a certain land value price, measured by per square foot per plot ratio, you add the construction and all ancillary costs, you get a sense of your margin and what you need to sell for. Now, what has happened is, because of potential higher replacement costs have gone up, and rightfully so. It's not driven by greed in any sense. Owners find themselves needing the comfort of a larger buffer. Sale price buffer. Yes. Mm. So that base land cost has now gone up. Mm. But in the meantime, even the value add cost, which is construction and miscellaneous interest, has gone up at least 50%, arising from all those factors that we just spoke about. So, and stamp duties have gone up.
Yes.
Risk factors have gone up. Mm. So when you add two enlarged components, the basic cost for a developer balloons substantially. So while the property might be in a great location, it's got good factors, it's freehold, it's MRT, it's in that right sweet spot where there's large amount of home buyers who would like to buy. But for most of the owners, it's come to a point where the mathematics or the economics do not stack up for the property developers. Mm. So as a result, and this is again a common problem that we're finding in most typical en bloc because of all these struggles and challenges. And so, which is why in the past, we used to see maybe a 1 in 3 success rate. That means for every 3 en blocs that gets thrown to the market, one tends to find a buyer. Slowly, it's been coming down to 1 in 4, then 1 in 5. Now, it's arguably 1 in 10 are successful. So that means for every 1 successful sale, there are 9 that would have got their 80% but can't find a buyer just because there is a mismatch between what works for a developer and what works for the owners.
Basically, it's a pricing gap between like the sellers and the buyers, right? So maybe you just want a quick check, right? So from a layman form of estimation, from a developer standpoint, what kind of profit margin will make sense for them to want to go for the en bloc? So for example, let's say, you know, like I'm a retail investor. I want to buy in a project that has en bloc potential. And I want to know like, okay, if this deal can go through at this kind of pricing, it'll work out for developers. So that it means my chance of getting on block, if I know some hidden information, there's a high chance for me to proceed.
Okay, so I think there's no simple answer to that question.
What kind of hidden information do you have?
So like hidden information is like you roughly, you know, like maybe understand, you know, like you talk to previous owners, roughly, you know, like maybe they are aiming at certain form of reserve price. And then from there, you know, you can, okay, this kind could make sense for like the developer, then you know that probably there's a higher chance that it will go through.
Right. In short, is Kramjit, you yourself, what kind of projects will you buy?
So, I'm struggling to think of a sensible way of answering that question. So again, you can't answer the question by looking at a particular project's absolute price, because 5 years ago, that same absolute price could have resulted in a particular break-even and a needful sale price. But now circumstances have all changed, that the same price requires the developer to mark up the project by potentially 15-20% more than previously. So then the question arises is, can the end market support the elevated sale prices? And if you take a view, you take an aggressive view and you like to go for it, then that's fine. But then it's a question of whether the developer has alternatives. If they have alternatives in the form of GLS and they prefer the safety of that, then I think that probably explains why most developers will just shy away from on blocks. So again, it's about the add-on costs that has basically messed up the economics, and that has messed up whether an on block is likely to be successful or not. And I'll just give you an example. Not long ago, when a developer buys a piece of land, they needed to pay 3% stamp duty on the value of the land. Today is 11%. So that extra bit has to go somewhere. So should the owners be absorbing that? But why should the owners absorb that? Because they will be thinking about replacement homes that have not gone down but has gone up. So if the owners are not absorbing that, and that's one of the multiple factors that have changed, then who's to absorb that? So inevitably, it ends up with the end buyers of the new condo, you know, needing to pay, you know, a higher and higher price for that. But there's a limit to how much you can push that, because again, back to whether there are alternatives. If there are alternatives, that probably explains why an en bloc will not, that particular en bloc will not take place.
So I think usually if we look at the reserve value and then we try to break it down into the per square foot PPR per plot ratio, we will roughly know whether the asking from the sellers are actually sort of like overpriced in the current context.
Correct. So that's a very transparent thing. There's a lot of information that's available in the public domain as to how developers are, what developers are paying for a piece of land. And, you know, when you have enough of comparables, then it basically, it tells the owners whether are they on the right path, are they pricing it right competitively enough to be able to attract bids, and or if they've inbuilt a premium just because they need the comfort of that, then they need to understand that the probability will be low. Then they will have to ask themselves whether should they even go through that process, because there is a downside of going through an on-block process only to fail with it, because it disrupts, you know, it disrupts what an owner can do, should not do, should they put a renovation on hold at the unit level or at the condo level. So there's something that you will have to give for, you know, making an attempt there. So it's not that it's a costly affair, but it's a potentially disruptive affair that times tends to lead to some anxiety issues.
Kramjit, if we remove two factors from good attributes of a project that has potential to en bloc. So, for example, let us remove the human factor. I mean, like, in the market, there's this term that in certain projects, there might be a group of owners that are not receptive to the concept of en bloc because of replacement home and all that kind of stuff. So, maybe we remove the human factor from the attributes list. And then the second factor to remove is, okay, maybe let us remove, although it's very hard to remove, but let us remove the part whereby the owners collectively want to achieve a certain reserve price. So let's remove that as well. So barring that two attributes being removed, what are the rest of the attributes that usually attracts developers to want to bid for a certain type of project? Like, is it like huge car park lot spaces that are not, you know, utilized, and plot ratios and things like that? What are some of these things that maybe you can share with our audience?
Well, actually, what is currently on site doesn't quite matter to a developer, because they will raise it down, they will tear it down and build afresh, whether it's got existing surface car park. I mean, it's not relevant to whether they wish to bid for it or not. What could go wrong when they assess a piece of land is if the component of development charges, which is a tax payable upon redeveloping or applying to redevelop it, is high in proportion to the entire land cost, then they can potentially be exposed to needing to pay higher rates if from the point of purchase To the time that they make the application, there is at least one or two DC rate increments along the way, because DC rates are adjusted every 6 months. So many developers, some developers have been exposed to a situation where in their minds, they thought that they would be paying, say, $200 million in DC, or now it's known as land betterment charge. But the end result, having gone through the entire process, that $200 million may balloon to, say, $300 million because of a variety of factors. So they would need to assess whether are the risk factors in that particular on block high. There are on blocks where actually the DC amount is small in proportion to the entire land value. So it would basically point that the risk factors in those situations are much more manageable. So that's one. Then obviously they will have to look at marketability of that project in the context of, you know, the target audience, who's going to likely buy. Are there BTOs with MOPs that will be just nice for them to be targeted to? Good schools, MRT stations, shopping malls, distance, commute times to CBD, all these factors, views. So once they've taken a complete assessment of that, that's when they can also internalize a view that they're taking of the market. Because when they buy a piece of land, they can only launch it potentially 15 months or sometimes 18 months after purchase. So they will have to kind of keep an eye as to where they think the market would be 1.5 to 2 years to 3 years from that point of time. If they're obviously bearish about the market, then no developer is going to buy. If they think it's going to be stagnant, then they will not be very too aggressive about bidding. And if they are reasonably confident and prepared to take the risk that, you know, there's probably upside about it, that's when they know that they will have to be competitive against other potential bidders.
So when we talk about competitions as such, especially when, let's say, they have en bloc this particular project, and then surrounding there is a series of government land sale that has yet to be launched. How would this potentially affect, you know, the outlook of this particular project that is about to go for en bloc?
Very good question. So it's all about, again, a marketability assessment. So what's the oversupply situation, undersupply situation? When was the last project in that localized area launch? Was it reasonably successful? What's going to compete at around the same time? So these are all factors that will have to be taken into consideration in actually making a decision. And that's not to say that since there is another competing project that might be heading towards the same time launch, that a developer should not partake, because sometimes GLS also does spring those kind of situations where you can have two sites in the same area that's launched and closed at the same time. So the Lentor area is one good example. And so developers will just have to price that situation and making an assessment about it. And if it needs to be a bit more cautious and price that in, then so be it.
Right. So speaking of Lentor, there's only one bidder for Lentor Gardens, and that was
the latest plot.
Yes, I think the price was at 900 plus per square foot per plot ratio. So is this a sign that, you know, the market is softening, given the one bidder that only bids for it, or are they waiting for other land plots to be available? For example, Bayshore.
Yeah. Bayshore is more BTO.
Yes.
So it doesn't really play into developers' mind because they don't partake in that. One bidder, what does that mean? And the bid price was marginally lower than the other sites that closed several months back. Multiple factors. One is, yes, maybe an assessment that there might be some pushback or indigestion because of the supply in that localized area. Secondly, whoever's bidding it will have to price in higher stamp duties arising from the latest budget in February. They will have to also price in the new age construction costs, and also what is known as this new calculation of what constitutes GFA and what's the strata area, and that will give rise to a drop in saleable efficiency. So when you factor that, then the price that they bid it actually sounds reasonable, fair and reasonable. But because they're the only bidder, does that send a wider signal about the market or the view of developers across the wider market? They definitely are concerns about factors that are beyond their control. Interest rates, high stamp duties, high construction costs. At some point of time, construction costs as a risk factor will normalize, will come down. At some point of time, high interest rates may normalize, but nobody can put a finger to when that will happen and to what extent will they start stabilizing down to. So that's beyond their control. But I think developers do recognize that there is an overall need to buy land and supply, because there is inherently demand for well-priced, well-designed, well-located condos, especially mass market. So I think business would resume back to normal when you have other GLS tenders closing. I don't think it's going to be one bidder in those cases. It's not going to be a flood of bids. But a lot of it depends on the scale of the project and whether it's mixed use and other factors.
Do you think developers are still hungry for land now?
Generally speaking, yes, that would be the answer. But they're also finding themselves in a difficult situation as to how to go about competing with one another, because they also need to be prudent and sensible about bidding. But many a times when they, in their minds, are prudent and sensible about bidding, they don't win it. Then is whether do they compete and take that undue risk about all the factors that are beyond their control, or just shy away from bidding. Fundamentally, if they're given an opportunity to buy land at fair value, there will be no shortage of developers bidding for it.
Right. So following up from Melvin's question, so are there like attributes or like checklists that if, let's say, a land site fulfills, there will be a higher chance of en bloc? I mean, like from a layman perspective, is definitely, I think, like the developer must be able to build maybe at least, you know, twice number of units, either because of the increase of plot ratio, or maybe because the current housing per unit, the size is big, and I can split it into maybe half.
You're still trying to find your golden pot, is it?
Like, or why don't you just ask Crumjit directly, which one will be successful over here?
I would say quite a number probably will not.
But actually, also interestingly, there are also non-resi, like Shenton House and Peninsula Excelsior Hotel. So do you think there will be also developers that will go for this type of property of plot nature?
In the current way that things are going, do you think actually like this kind of commercial sites are actually more attractive?
Yeah.
In the eyes of a developer? Of course, going back to Yuron's question, so the attributes.
So maybe I start with the simplest question first. So yes, interestingly, mixed-use development projects are beginning to creep in being a bit more successful than the plain vanilla on blocks. And that's because of the unique addition of costs that's attributable to residential properties, the high stamp duties or so. Some of this mixed use on blocks represent an opportunity for the buyer to refurbish them rather than tear down and redevelop it, especially if they've got a renting model in mind for these kind of projects. So then the high construction cost becomes lesser of a factor in when they plan for the refurbishment or A&A for it. So that's on that question. Factors, well, ultimately, every project, yeah, it comes down to, you know, perception of price in relation to what they can do with the property in that end again, applying a different lens unique to each developer as to what their outlook of the market is expected to be. There are developers who are obviously more risk adverse, some are risk takers, some believe that they will have to accumulate supply because they're running short of inventory. So that would force them to take a bit more risk in bidding. So it's all about unique factors to the developers, but fundamentally, there's no running away from the fact that it must make sense economically for both the sellers and the buyers. And many a times there is that pricing gap that you just spoke about. And if the pricing gap can't be bridged, no issues with developers not bidding for it.
How about like projects whereby, you know, it seems like just from the look of it, it has been already maxed out, right? In terms of this land size, there's no increment in plot ratio, there's no increment in the amount of levels you can build. I mean, like, should the owners even try to attempt to do it?
So the answer to that is that it doesn't matter. There are very successful en blocs that have no upside in plot ratio, so to speak. That means the GFA has been maxed out. And it's just a matter of the developer pulling it down and redeveloping, keeping the same gross floor area, but they're free to reconfigure the sizes.
Right.
So the very fact that you've already maxed out your potential in relation to the redevelopment potential doesn't mean that a project like that is unblockable,
right.
For lack of a better word.
Mm.
And the reason that can still give rise to an on-block opportunity despite maxed out GFA is there is always a huge premium that gets attributed to brand new projects compared to resale projects. Mm. So when you take that into consideration and when you apply the improvement cost, which is your construction cost and miscellaneous, if there's still an arbitrage, yeah, developers will go for that.
Right. Have you ever seen any projects that has been successfully on block for those projects that are below 10 years old?
Very, very rare. I
because you need 90%.
You need 90%, you're absolutely right.
Have there been any success cases in Singapore?
I can't think of a project off the top of my head, but there could have been, not recently, certainly not recently, but in the past, in one of those previous cycles, there could have been, but nothing pops out. Right. There have been attempts that we are aware of, but in most cases, we've been advising the owners, you know, it's probably better to wait this out because it's very difficult to engineer a sensible price that, you know, bearing in mind that the project is still reasonably new. And if you have, then it's a bit of an economic loss also, pulling down a perfectly well-built development that's in a good condition, new, just to replace it in all probability with the same GFA, but brand new form.
Right. Yeah.
So if let's say this group of homeowners, they are the OGs of this development, that means majority of them, they are like the first owners. This also means that their buffer is significantly higher than, say, a second or a third owner. Of course, they have to go for a replacement home. Does it mean that this type of demographics will then have a slightly more flexible reserve price? And then this gap would then be able to address. Does this factor actually even plays a part in the resulting success of an en-bloc sale?
Difficult to generalize because you're right also, while they might be sitting on historical low purchase prices, and so you would imagine they would be, you know, quite comfortable with not maximizing or perceiving to maximize their sale price, and they will be more flexible. But I think most owners ignore what they paid for it maybe 20, 30, 40 years ago, but look upon the on-block proposition in relation to what it's currently worth, because that's actually their opportunity cost. If their opportunity cost is they're able to sell that at 2 million, for example, never mind that they paid 200,000 for it many decades ago, and the on-block proposition is 2.5, then they might struggle with that half a million premium, irrespective. So they will be having an eye more of what is it currently worth, and because that also tells them what they would need to spend when looking for a replacement home, ignoring the fact that they might have paid 200,000 or 300,000.
So it doesn't really matter.
Almost doesn't really matter. Yeah.
Okay.
So sometimes I see that, like, you know, like, so for some projects, the third time is the charm.
There are some cases, and there's probably some evidence, and it's probably a case where they've wisened up,
adjust their expectations.
They've adjusted. They've learned from previous exercises. They've learned from the failed attempts that, guys, this time let's get it right. You know, they wouldn't be able to know that they missed the opportunity in the previous two times. Maybe they were late in the cycle and the timing was off, but usually it's a question of having priced it over the market. And so if they've learned from that and have adjusted in relation to the market, and since the first and second time the market also is on their side, having gone up, then that's where the confluence of factors lead to a high probability in your third time charming situation.
I see. So some basic questions. So when they first put up for a tender, how long are developers given to actually partake in the bidding?
So how long does a tender is open for? Usually for about anywhere between 4 to 6 weeks.
So 4 to 6 weeks. If it's not successful, they can do a private treaty for up to 10 weeks, you mentioned.
That's correct.
And then if, let's say, they still fail to secure a buyer,
you
mentioned that they can still go and have one last chance in terms of trying for like a tender?
They can call for a second tender. And if time permits, they could potentially even call for a third tender, usually a very short third tender, because all of that has to be managed within 12 months from the time that they did secure 80%. And within that 12 months, they would need to secure a buyer and make an application to the Strata Titles Board, which that process also takes maybe sometimes 6 to 8 weeks or so. Mm. So when you factor that, then effectively they've got 10 to 10 and a half months to actually market it. And then once you factor the tender, typical reasonable tender process, then most en blocs have 2 shots at it, sometimes 3 shots at it.
Within the same 12-month cycle.
That's right.
Okay, nice. I spoke to an investor before that told me he was successful 3 times in terms of identifying an en bloc project. And then these are the tips that he gave me. So he mentioned that, okay, maybe not too big a land size, $300 to $400 million worth, so it's easier for the developers to digest. He personally prefers a freehold property attribute from the angle that he understands that he might need to hold for 10 years before the en bloc can happen. And he is okay that even if the en bloc doesn't happen, because it's freehold. And his viewpoint is that once the more senior owners who want a house, who probably will object to the en bloc because of, like, you know, like needing to change a new environment, if they were to pass on, the beneficiaries would be open to want to have an en bloc. So how do you find this strategy?
There are quite a number of seasoned investors.
Successful en bloc pickers.
Correct.
Right.
But the key thing that you would notice is that chances are they would have the luxury of being able to wait out. But if you are boring to the hilt and you're sitting on tight cash flows and high borrowing is a risk factor, then you would want a quick turnaround as much as possible. And if you're gaming for that, then that's not a good idea because of all these challenges of, you know, being successful. But if you're prepared and you've got the means to wait it out, then I think these are all very good and relevant and relevant, basically, success factors to look out for. In addition to that, if obviously the project has en bloc before and have basically warmed up to the whole phenomena, then that would be the added bonus, so to speak. You pointed out to if the next generation typically will become less emotively attached to the property. Yes, that's potentially a relevant factor. But yeah, if an investor can wait it out, take the risk, sit it out, if it doesn't happen within 3 to 5 years and they can take at least a 10-year view, why not?
So should a family that wouldn't want an en bloc to happen, but they just like this particular project that has failed twice in its en bloc, should they still buy it? Just to stay.
Yeah, and adding on to that question, right? Because we talk about the timeline, which is if let's say when they are purchasing it, there are no talks of en bloc. Suddenly, the moment after they purchase it and then the plot ratio change and then after it started to attract potential en bloc discussion, the timeline will then be about, will definitely be more than a year to form the 80% and then to find a buyer. Is it also true that, adding to Melvin's question, is that by the time, let's say, they manage to find a buyer, it would be within the second or the third year of the seller stamp duty cycle?
Yes, they would be exposed, potentially exposed to SSD liability, and that will still be applicable to an owner who doesn't support the en bloc. So because they are being forced to an arrangement, and so they would still be exposed to SSD. And if and based on the example that you've just outlined, that it gets kickstarted just after buying it, then yeah, it's within 3 years. It's a very real probability. As for an owner who's looking to buy for own stay and prefers not to be disrupted by an en bloc, I would say the best would be buy landed. Because in landed, you can't be forced out because the 80% rule doesn't apply. And if you hold your ground and you say that you don't wish to sell with your adjoining landed property owners for redevelopment, for example, you could say no.
Right. Like the one in the Geylang.
Yeah, that reminds me of the one in the Geylang. So like all the owners beside them sold, and then they create a very interesting development.
Yeah. So that's the...
There are multiple examples in the past, especially Row of Terraces, where you have many of them saying yes, but some said no. Then there are more additional challenges right now, because in those kind of situations, URA do impose minimum land area before a Row of Terraces can be redeveloped into maybe a different housing form. So you need to look at not only the land area of the plot that is willing to sell, but also what is known as the breakaway lot in that row. So it just opens up a different can of worms there.
Right.
The last topic that we want to prick your brains. So so we're debating on this on the last episode. This is where we are at right now. We are in Q2 2023, and our landed price index, non-landed residential price index, HDB price index. What is your own personal forecast? Of course, we'll put in the disclaimer for you again. But what is your own personal forecast? Because we're debating on the fact that recently HDB policies has attracted, HDB prices has attracted a lot of policies. Including the latest round where a owner have to wait out 15 months before they can purchase unless they are at least 55 and above and things like that. So where do you think this line will eventually go to? Do you think that it will sort of taper? And what do you think will happen to our condo and apartment pricing as well as landed property pricing in the next 5 years? So we're just trying to look at, will there be a huge gap between public housing as well as private properties, looking at how things are going? Because it does seem like private properties are picking up a lot of strength, especially with the reopening of a lot of global countries. There's a huge viewpoint that Singapore now is like one of the very top tier safe haven from overseas investors. Everybody's fleeing and trying to put their money in countries that has sound governance and things like that. So what do you think is going to happen in future? Of course, our government has done a lot of job in terms of ensuring that everybody has a chance to own their own properties, whether it's a BTO or resale, HDBs or things like that. So your personal viewpoint on pricing moving forward?
No simple answers to that.
This pertains to the next generation.
Yeah. So the general principles about if you look at this chart, you would see, you know, it's cyclical, generally cyclical. So there's no way that we would see a situation where prices will just rise and not come down, not dip. Why would prices come down? Prices will come down whenever there is an inherent weakness in the economy, where people are not earning as much as they did. There is shrinkage of savings, but more importantly, where there is a supply glut. And whenever you look back in history, when prices came down, it's largely because of a supply glut situation. Right now, we've got headwinds, but we don't have a supply glut. We've got supply. It's undersupplied. So which is why prices are still moving up. Now, but that's just summing up the essence of it. But there are multiple back issues connecting with generally how, as a nation, we're thinking about the profile of the immigrants that are coming on board, you know, the population growth arising from immigration, because we do have a declining population trend. So obviously, we're not reproducing enough to replace ourselves. So the only way that we could increase our population base is through immigration. So that comes into factor. Then obviously marriage rate, the number of marriages that forms new households, has a part to play. Fundamentally, you've got a situation where new people have come on, and because of high stamp duties, they find themselves that they can't buy as they come into Singapore, just so immediately because of high stamp duties as a foreigner. So they rent. There's a shortage of homes for a whole variety of reasons why rents have gone up. So they will need to see whether is that sustainable. But because HDB and private, if you look back in history, you would find that they are actually quite closely correlated. If HDB prices remain weak, it has a knock-on effect on the entry level of private condominiums, because affordability of private condominiums is in turn dependent on the ability to of HDB dwellers in being able to sell and upgrade, and, you know, depends on how much premium they're able to make, so on and so forth. So I doubt it would diverge to the extent that you've just outlined. They would come together in the ups and lows also. The luxury end of properties and landed have a life of their own, less correlated to the fundamentals of HDB and mass market. Landed is living in its own bubble, and they can afford to live in its own bubble because there's no new landed supply, you know. So, and while wealth is on the rise, it's only that many landed properties.
So this will be your chart.
That's your chart. and then luxury is a different thing altogether again, because it's all about, you know, the profile of the parties who are coming in and paying top dollar for luxury home and with a huge surplus in the form of stamp duties. And they would need to take a look at the entire quantum that they're paying, the base cost plus stamp duties in totality, in making a decision whether they are, you know, going for it. And then there's still quite a number of cases where foreigners have bought high-end homes and have paid almost 40% in stamp duties. And that's huge.
In your personal recommendation to a friend, if your friend of yours is able to, afford a landed home, and as well as a CCR condominium, what would you advise your friend?
Well, I would say landed easily, because landed still appeals to wealthy Singaporeans who potentially could pay less stamp duties. Luxury end, there's a higher probability that you would need to target foreigners. And with the rate at which ABSD has been on the rise, I don't see ABSD coming down. So it's either remaining where it is, or if not, go up, you know, over time. So the risk factors would continue to rise. And that seems, if their buyer is a Singaporean, then, and you you have the ability to pay, to buy landed, then I think landed would be the way to go.
So I was very happy with your answer, because I did a V-shape, because in the last episode I mentioned that the lender and HDB cannot just have like a total full divergence. There's some form of correlation. Of course, the gap will widen and come out. You mentioned that the previous cycles, of course, usually prices come down because of supply glut, right? But I wanted to just clarify, actually, a lot of the previous situation when prices came down, it was usually created, correlated to like a global or regional crisis, like Asian financial crisis, dot-com bubble, GFC. Of course, from 2013 onwards, we have this series of cooling measures that sort of like, you know, I of course understand that prices cannot just come out on a straight line. There will be a certain form of pullback. But can we say that with all these cooling measures in place, they are sufficient enough to not have the market crash like last time used to be like 40% kind of crashing, and maybe a pullback will be something more like what we see in 2013 when total debt servicing ratio is implemented 3-4% down on a yearly basis, and that is what is considered our worst case scenario from a residential context in Singapore.
I think you've outlined a very good point. Ironically, what appears to be the risk factor in investing in Singapore is actually our saving grace. It basically, the cooling measures, the accumulated set of cooling measures have ensured that our prices have not run away from fundamentals. We are nowhere close to a bubble market. And there's a lot of talk that, you know, Singapore is in a bubble, and many other countries and markets do see bubbles taking place because of a lack of regulation. But because we're so highly regulated, our market is, I would dare say, it's very grounded. So, and in fact, we did a report precisely on this in the face of COVID, and we made that prediction that we don't see prices coming down despite COVID, purely underpinned by the strength of the market arising from the cooling measures. Mm. That has ensured that market remains prudent, borrowing remains prudent, and home buyers would only do so if they actually have the ability to make a purchase or upgrade or downgrade, whichever the case is. So that is actually a huge strength factor that will precisely mitigate our downside. Mm. But you've also touched on other points. We've seen prices coming down during the global financial crisis, but that also coincided with a supply glut situation at that point of time. We went through another major economic crisis, global economic crisis in the form of COVID, that basically messed up many markets, disrupted and contracted and diminished wealth in many markets. And yet our prices didn't go down. And that's because it coincided with the situation where we were undersupplied.
Mm.
So that's the key difference between why it behaved differently in those different major global economic crisis.
So in 2021, 2022, will you attribute mainly because we are in an undersupply situation, and of course, maybe the spillover effect of the printing of cheap money from the US, all this as a combined factor for the price run in the 2021
and
to 2022?
And also the prudence and the strength that is inherent in the market arising from the prudence instilled by the cooling measures.
Okay, but why didn't prices already start climbing, let's say, you know, like in 2019? Because, I mean, like in terms of like the CPF savings rate building and all that, these are all factors, or like income increases, these are all factors that has already been present for like a long time.
Supply situation. So it became more and more apparent that the market was heading towards a lower supply overhang than ever before. And that's why you see that huge jump up in prices.
What are your thoughts about the recent bank crisis in the US, and combined with the interest rate effect? What are your own personal, I would say predictions on like how the market will perform in 2023 and 2024?
The factors that led to those banks from being bought out are actually quite unique to decisions made by those banks, or at least that would be what appears to be the case. The key question is whether that would lead to a contagion effect that will lead to a domino that messes up and disrupts the global order, the banking order, is yet to be seen. I think it's difficult to say that it's heading in that direction just as yet. There are so many differing views amongst experts in that space. And we are, obviously, I'm not an expert in that space. Closer towards home, you know, you would recall during the Asian financial crisis, we had multiple banks. And the government basically forced the mergers of the smaller banks towards three main local banks. And the three main local banks are, I think, sitting on very solid balance sheets. They're doing exceptionally well. They've recovered and perform well arising from the last COVID crisis. So I think they're sitting on, they're in good shape. And bulk of our assets are with the three local banks. So that gives some comfort, and there's a lot of prudence in the management of the financial systems. But there are absolutely risk factors. I mean, the collapsing of the banks, high interest rates, the management of that, you know, the ability to get... Well, there's also a semblance that many have got into speculative investments, whether you place crypto or different forms of new instruments in that category. It depends on how much wealth is created, how much wealth is lost. The key question is whether is that happening in small pockets along the whole way? And if that's the case, then I think we should be fine. Your last point is on high interest rates. That definitely has a knock-on effect on the ability to service loan. The good news is while asset values have continued to climb, household wealth and savings have continued to climb, overall debt, while that has climbed, but it has not climbed in tandem with the values of household wealth. So 10 years ago, debt used to be about 20% of asset value or household net worth. Today, it has, although in absolute terms it's gone up, it's come down to 14%. And that's because it has remained prudent with TDSR as a control mechanism. But more importantly, wealth has continued to drive the accumulated household wealth as a society.
Great, awesome. Okay, final question because of time constraint from George.
Yeah, so do you foresee home ownership to reduce from the fact that TDSR have actually dropped down to the current state of 55%. And then I think a lot of youngsters right now, probably 20 years down the road, their thinking might be different. Instead of putting a huge chunk in terms of the down payment to the house, right now it's 25%. I don't know, you know, 20 years down the road, how many percent would it be? Do you think they will then be shifting their mindset into rental apartments instead of buying a house?
The answer to that is we've got to look at who we are as a society. The Asian society prefers, you know, home ownership rather than feeling vulnerable about needing to move as a tenant. Many other societies are quite comfortable moving around, not owning your home. Asian societies have this tendency towards building a legacy and saving for your next generation. Right or wrong, it's arguable, but it's very ingrained in our Asian society. So we save, we work hard, but we also, you know, keeping for the next generation and maybe grandsons and so on and so forth. So now you've got to ask yourself whether has that culture changed over time? And so that might point to different answers. The alternative, there's some argument towards, you know, renting, but many a times when you look back in history, Singapore has remained a very good performing housing market. So if they were to not be invested when everybody else, 90%+ of our society, is a property owner, then there might be a chance. And there's a high risk that they might just miss the opportunity, having climbed down the ladder, to eventually climb up the ladder at a later point of time, because prices just tend to rise gradually over time. So they will have to figure that out. Foreigners have no choice to be tilted towards rental because of high stamp duties. Is that good or bad? Well, if you're a local, obviously you will feel that that adds to a layer of protection, ensuring that property prices remain as affordable as they can potentially be, favoring locals against foreigners. If you're a foreigner, obviously, you know, this would be an issue.
Great. Thank you very much. Yeah, maybe just one question because of time constraint. So, Kramjit, what advice would you have for our young people in Singapore? I mean, if you can give like one to two advices for them to plan for their future with relation to, of course, their own personal well-being as well as like planning for their home as well. Yeah.
Well, I think we here in Singapore, and this might sound like a politician here, but I'm not. But I do genuinely admire the entire HDB infrastructure and the social objectives behind the design of the policies, the economics around the grants, the subsidy at which it's being offered, the quality of the bill. They are literally world-class. Now, all you need to do is to catch a flight and travel about the world. Then only you will come back and realize that actually we've got a very generous and a beautiful way of starting off their life once you get married, and to BTO your beginning journey of your married life. So whether it's going to be 5 years tied down, whether it's 10 years tied down, and now you've got options of being able to own a HDB flat in a prime located. And that's, I think it's phenomenal. I think it's a great way of starting off your life. It's a prudent way of tying down less debt and less capital involved so that you could live comfortably with ideally CPF taking care of the installments. And then while you focus on developing your career, working hard in an upliftment in your earning potential, and then over that 5 or 10 years period, you enjoy the uplift in your HDB flat or BTOs. And whether you would like to carry on living in that or whether you feel that you would like to put more and more of your earnings, future earnings and savings into a new home, be able so that you can able to live a certain lifestyle, that's a trade-off that you will have to make at that point of time. There's nothing wrong in staying in a HDB flat. I think it's a very wise thing to do even after MOP, because it just means that you will have a larger amount of disposable income for a different quality of life, or you could use that for a form of investments or enterprise or so. Now, but if they are totally game for it and they've got the ability to afford, absolutely by all means, they could think about replacing it and upgrading. But the good thing is that you've got frameworks that ensures prudency in what you can, what you can't do. And because parents are usually property owners, again, because back to Asian culture, a lot of parents do save up for the kids. And that's where parents do come in handy to help get them off their grounds and as they start their life together as a married couple. So a combination of these cultural aspects and the great HDB machinery that we have here, and I would dare say it's a very generous grant, I think this would be the ideal way of kickstarting your life.
Great. Awesome. Thank you. Thanks for your time today. It means a lot to us and our audience. I think we have learned a great deal about En Bloc, and a lot of questions has been answered. And We want to thank Mr. Kramjit basically for his precious time here. So if you want to find out more about what he does and of course on his LinkedIn profile and company profile, the links are all provided down in the description box below. And feel free to reach him. Are you open for our audience to reach you? I mean, like if you have any questions about OnBlock and stuff like that.
No, I'm happy to help out. So right, I think I can share with my email address here.
Right, awesome, great. So thank you for staying tuned on our banter series number 7 in terms of our episode. And we want to see you on the next one. So what we're going to do is that every month we're going to bring on a different guest as far as we can. Of course, Kramjit, if anybody that you want to recommend to come on to our podcast, feel free to ping me. Sure. And we hope to see you soon. Take care. Bye.